Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The People versus Bruce. Or was it Lenny Bruce versus the People? A couple of literate lawyers have taken the time to reconstruct the trials of Lenny Bruce, trials of the early 60s that took the comic on a treadmill of obscenity charges through courtrooms and jail cells from San Francisco and L.A. to Chicago to New York. From the screaming entertainment high of a Carnegie Hall performance to Bruce's ignoble end on a bathroom floor, a convicted comic and a social critic with a needle in his arm. But for those of us who thought that Lenny Bruce looked an awful lot like Dustin Hoffman, for those of us who grew up thinking that Bruce was somehow more trendy, liberal, and Gentile, rather than perverse, radical, and unassimilatedly Jewish, this is a new look at the legal side of Lenny's life, raising one key question. And Connection listeners, we need your help on this one as well. Why is it that after so many courtroom battles, victories, and defeats, Lenny Bruce is known merely as a cultural icon, not as a champion of the First Amendment? Did you see Lenny Bruce perform? Did you hear free speech or just dirty talk? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The new book that we're talking about is called The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon. It was written by Ron Collins and David Scover. David is a law professor at Seattle University. He joins us from the West Coast, and Ron is with the First Amendment Center, part of the Freedom Forum in Arlington, Virginia. He's here with me in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Now, before we dig into a little bit of legal theory, let's dig into a little bit of Lenny himself. Connection listeners, a warning for you. Lenny Bruce was controversial in the 1950s and the 1960s, seen and heard by many as offensive and vulgar. Many people, perhaps many, feel the same way in 2002. And so we'll be hearing a few different clips of performances this hour, if you would rather not hear them. If you have kids in the car and you don't want to expose them to what could be sexual or very harsh, culturally critical notions, we don't encourage you to tune out, but we offer that option. We're going to start with a cut that's not necessarily chronologically early. This is late in Bruce's career, after he's been busted. Bruce commenting in concert while he's awaiting trial on being dragged out of a club and into a San Francisco courtroom on a charge of using a certain 10-letter word. This shtick's called blah, blah, blah.
The bust. What I got arrested for in San Francisco. San Francisco, I got arrested for, what did they, we can hear that, Daddy. I'm not going to repeat the word because I want to finish the gig here tonight. It's, they said it was vernacular for a favorite homosexual practice, a 10-letter word. It's really chic. That's 2 4-letter words and a preposition. I can't, I wish I could tell you the word. It's, starts with a C. Well, you know what the word is. Now, it's weird how they manifested that word as homosexual, because I don't. That relates to any contemporary chick I know, or would love, or would marry, you know. And, now, when I took the bust, I finished the show, I said that word, you know, the 10-letter word, and he comes over and says, Lenny, my name is Sergeant Blah Blah. You know the word you said? I said a lot of words that time. Well, that word. Oh, yeah. Well, Lenny, that's against the law. I'm going to take you down. Okay, that's cool. It's against the law to say it and to do it. Well, I didn't do it, man. I know, but I just have to tell you that all the time. Okay. All right. Now, get in the court, take the same bus, the judge, Aaron Avramitz, a redheaded junkyard Jew, a real fabissiner with thick fingers and a homemade glass eye. Tuffo, right? He comes in, blah, blah, blah. Swear the heat in. What'd he say? Your Honor, he said blah, blah, blah. The judge, he said blah, blah, blah. Then the guy really yented it up. That's right. I didn't believe it. There was a guy up on the stage in front of women in a mixed audience saying, blah, blah, blah. The judge. This I never heard. Blah, blah, blah. Said blah, blah, blah. He said blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to lie to you. It's in the minutes. I'm not going to lie to you. All right. The DA. The guy said blah, blah, blah. Look at him. He's smug. He's not going to repent. Then I dug something. They sort of like saying blah, blah, blah. Because they said it a few extra times.
Lenny Bruce, 1961. And we're talking this hour not about the life and times of Lenny Bruce, but specifically about the legal aspect of Lenny Bruce's career. With me in the studio, Ron Collins. He is a lawyer, a specialist on the First Amendment. David Scover's with us from Seattle. They co-authored the book together. And guys, we're talking about what's obscene. Was it illegal? Why didn't the First Amendment protect Bruce? But set the table for us to begin with, David. Why was it that we never, why is it that we never talk about Lenny Bruce when we talk about the history of the First Amendment?
None of Lenny Bruce's obscenity cases ever got before the Supreme Court. You know, if that had happened, then his name would have been well known in First Amendment law. But not since none of his cases ever went that far, he's virtually unknown in the annals of constitutional law. But even so, and this point is really quite remarkable, he established a legal, not a legal precedent, an important legal Supreme Court precedent, but a practical one. Maybe Ron can address that.
Yeah, as David said, had this case gone to the Supreme Court, every lawyer, every law student, every judge, and the people generally would think, equate Lenny Bruce not just as a great comedian, but as a great First Amendment figure. That never happened. But as a practical matter, and this is what David's saying, once Lenny died in August of 1966, once that ended, I think the world of comedy was shocked at what he had endured. They knew about the busts in the various cities. They knew about the prices he paid, the bankruptcy, all of that. And as a practical matter, after Lenny Bruce died, comedy clubs became free speech zones. By that I mean, as a practical matter, there weren't any, to speak of, significant busts in comedy clubs for words alone anymore after Lenny Bruce died. That's a remarkable feat, a remarkable contribution to our culture, I think, that when I said that comedy clubs had become free speech zones, that comedians can go up there and speak their minds without fear of being hauled off to jail.
It's almost, David, though, as if Lenny Bruce had to die for that to happen, that there had to be some martyrdom, right?
Well, it's true. Lenny Bruce was a man who sacrificed his career, he sacrificed his fortune, and ultimately he sacrificed his very life for the American principle of freedom of speech. I mean, the interesting thing about Lenny Bruce is that he, as he approached the end of his life, he became more and more and more Lenny the lawyer and less Lenny the comedian. He used his famous line more often than not in the comedy clubs. He would say, "I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce." So he was indicating by this very famous statement that he repeated and repeated that actually his life now was dedicated to a principle of freedom of speech in the comedy clubs, and that he just didn't see himself as a one-liner comedian.
And it's probably worth noting at the time that it wasn't just the explicit use of words, which at that time weren't so much a part of the workplace or the sports establishment that are still considered four-letter words, but a lot of pretty risky talk about religion. He had a piece on Christ and Moses when he took on New York's Cardinal Spellman and others. Basically, if I get this right, Ron, and correct me if I have it wrong, Christ and Moses are visiting St. Patrick's Cathedral. They're standing in the back and wondering at the hypocrisy. And just about at this point, if I'm not mistaken, Cardinal Spellman's castigating the lepers for leaving their parts around.
It's
just general chaos. Right?
Take your Hebrew national banner down. Mr. Jessel, will you get off the Madonna? That's not a stat. All right, give me a direct line to Rome, quickly. Rome. All right. Hello. John Friend in New York. Listen, a couple of kids dropped in, and, yeah, you know them. Well, I can't really talk right now. Excuse me. Hello, we're from Newsweek, and we want to know if they have State Department clearance, and is that really them? Yes, it is them. Sonny, get off my hand. Yes, that is them, dear, yes. I don't know if they're going to do any tricks today. I don't know. Yes, they can fly. No, Mary Martin isn't God's mother, and get the hell out of here now. Hello. You know them. One kid is, with a cross of bop. No, not Zorro. Damn, that's right. He brought a very attractive Jewish boy with him. Oh, he got to do something. Well, I know, I can't put him up at your place. No, I didn't paint or anything. Oh, I got a lot of kids staying over here. Look, what are we paying protection for? That's right. Just get him over here, that's all. Yeah. I don't want to hear about that. Look, all I know is that we're up to our ass in crutches and wheelchairs. Is that good enough for you? The place is ridiculous here. Yeah. They're in the back. Way in the back. Of course they're white. Yeah.
Ron Collins, he did that in Chicago 40 years ago, a town that would have reacted 10 years ago with some horror to what he was saying.
Yeah, he did it at the Gate of Horn, and that bit, which is reproduced on the CD in the book, was very controversial. This was a very Irish Catholic community. When you go dissing not only cardinals, but the whole institution of the church, you know, the hypocrisy, as he saw it, of the church, its great wealth and its, as he portrayed it, its lack of concern for the poor. I mean, in Christ and Moses, the reason why the cardinals are concerned is they want those lepers out of the church. It may be that Christ and Moses have come back to this earth, but if those lepers are going to come and, you know, drop skin in their cathedral, there's no place there for them. And so it's incredible, but Lenny was busted for that bit at the Gate of Horn. He was essentially, although not formally, but practically speaking, he was charged, in effect, with blasphemy, and he had to defend that in a court of law in Chicago. And what's even more remarkable is when Lenny went to trial, it was a Wednesday, and he went there with his Jewish New York lawyer, and everybody in the courtroom had ashes on their forehead, the judge, the jury, the bailiff, everybody. It was Ash Wednesday.
David, in your view, did Lenny Bruce pick these targets, these particular targets, because he wanted to challenge the First Amendment? Or was he a comic looking to shock, looking to get a laugh out of something that had never been laughed at publicly?
Well, actually, I think the answer to that is yes and yes, and probably other things in addition. I mean, Lenny's psychology was extraordinarily complex. And what you're really asking me is a question of his, having to do with his sort of psychological mindset, what he was doing in his comedy. That's, you know, an extremely difficult question to answer, because I think that his motivations were mixed. There was a certain smarty pants quality of Lenny Bruce. He liked to throw dirt into the face of the establishment just for the fact of doing that. But at the same time, there was a serious quality in his comedy. He had an anathema. He had a hatred for hypocrisy. To him, hypocrisy was one of the greatest of sins. And he had no problem at all in puncturing the political, the religious, the social, the economic establishment for their hypocrisies. The Christ and Moses event that you, or the Christ and Moses routine that you just played, is a fine example of it. I mean, here we have Cardinal Spellman talking to Pope John about why he can't have the lepers in his church, when, of course, the Christ that church is to be celebrating brought in the lepers and healed them. So you see the hypocrisy there.
Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about the history of Lenny Bruce's challenge to the First Amendment. It means talking a little bit about Sam Roth and Justice William J. Brennan, community standards, a little bit of legal lesson, and a little more Lenny Bruce. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Did you ever see the man perform? Your thoughts. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about The Trials of Lenny Bruce. That's the title of a new book by Ron Collins and David Scover, exploring explicitly the First Amendment connections that exist between Lenny Bruce and that particular time in history, and why it is that we think of him today principally as a cultural icon rather than someone who pushed some of the legal margins. And just a reminder to listeners who may have tuned in, we are playing some of Lenny Bruce's routines on the program today. There are people who have said that these are offensive. If you are one of them, you're advised that perhaps some of the language on the program today will be something beyond what you're used to expecting. Now, we need to do a little bit of legal background here, and Ron, I'm going to put you to work on the case that was used as the precedent. Whenever Lenny was arrested and charged with obscenity, whether it was San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, there was that ruling from the Sam Roth case where a justice of the Supreme Court, William J. Brennan, had said that what a definition of obscenity turned on was whether to a reasonable person applying contemporary standards, the dominant theme of the material appeals to prurient interests.
Well, there's the rub. There's the rub, literally and figuratively. What is prurient interest? I mean, is it erotic? You know, is it something that, you know, as Lenny said, will get you horny? So if you hear these words that rhyme with luck, will that make you horny? That's one standard. Or is it something that's vulgar? Is it tasteless? Is it offensive? Well, the problem with that is it's not just Lenny's words that were offensive. It was his ideas. And if words could be offensive, then so could ideas. And if ideas could be offensive, what's become of the First Amendment? So that was the whole debate with the Lenny Bruce issue. He said, look, my words don't turn on anybody, you know. But they busted him nevertheless because there was this idea that obscenity could mean offensive words.
And he was close, wasn't he? He was so close to being able to take this point, his case, to the Supreme Court if he had done a couple of the steps that he tripped over in the latter years of his life, he might very well have had a chance to make that case and write himself into the
Lenny,
books.
Lenny had some of the finest First Amendment lawyers in the country, almost 30 of them,
yeah.
Most of them which he fired at one time or another.
And most of them he didn't pay, too.
He knew how to stiff him as well as the next guy. You know, that's the incredible story about Lenny Bruce. And that's what we're trying to get at in this book, you know, to kind of bring that story back, that incredible First Amendment story back to life.
There was something about the man on the stage. There was something about the way that he stood up there. I'd marked something in the book because I liked the way that Ron, you and David had written it. It was... you had to hear him and see him to believe him, to sense what his live stand-up, shoot-down, blow-up, zigzag comedy was like. Well, Nat Hentoff was one of the people who saw Lenny Bruce and saw him a lot on stage, and he joins us on the line. Hi, Nat.
Good day.
Did it matter a lot to see him rather than just hear him?
Oh, my goodness. That's why he kept begging, literally begging judges to let him do his act rather than some guy from the License Bureau or an ex-CIA agent is in New York. He was very, very visual and very conscious of, for one thing, for example, he started in strip clubs where most of the musicians were jazz musicians, and there was a bond between them. The jazz guys, used to taking risks, enjoyed the fact that he did, and being irreverent themselves, they enjoyed his humor, and he dug what they were doing. And if you listen to the rhythms of his performances, like, for example, the to as a preposition, come as a verb, or some of the ones you've been playing, he, like a good musician, knew how to use space and particularly dynamics. And he played the microphone as an instrument, which I think you're going to hear in this recording of his to as a preposition. He also... in terms of seeing him, he interacted, to say the least, with the audience. He did stride around. He obviously felt whatever they were thinking or feeling. My favorite Lenny Bruce memory, he played the Village Vanguard in New York, which at the time was probably one that had the most multicultural audiences in the city or the country. By race, by gender, by sexual preference, by vocation, whatever. And one night he strode in, looked at the audience, and they were prepared for him. They were there because they knew who Lenny Bruce was. And he looked around and he said, "Hey, any kikes here tonight? Any spicks? Any niggers?" And the audience froze. What had gotten into this guy? Some dibbuk? And then he looked at him and said, "Now, why are you reacting that way?" And then he went into the history of those words and why were they paralyzed by the words. Of course, this never had any effect on any plainclothes guy in the audience who was trying to bust him.
The power of words, no question about that. You made up a reference to a well-known shtick of Lenny's, to as a preposition, come as a verb. Let's just listen to a little bit of that now.
To is a preposition, to is a preposition, come is a verb. To is a preposition, come is a verb. To is a preposition, come is a verb, the verb intransitive. To come. To come. I've heard these two words my whole adult life, and as a kid when I thought I was sleeping. To come. To come. It's been like a big drum solo. Did you come? Did you come good? 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 Rex the Cartier, I come better with you, sweetheart, than anyone in the whole goddamn world.
Nat Hentoff is with us. He is longtime columnist with The Village Voice, a writer on constitutional issues. Nat, you testified on his behalf. You were pretty close to him in his latter years.
Well, sure. You know, he didn't start out to be a First Amendment scholar, but he became one because it was as serious as his life, as his career. And I remember during the trial and afterwards when he was in New York, he used to hole up in a hotel in the Village, and I'd come to see him, and literally all over the place, on the floor, on the kitchen table, on the stove even, there were legal briefs and books on the First Amendment. He became a passionate believer that he was going to be vindicated. He couldn't see how he could not be vindicated.
Let's just hear the end of that routine, if we can. Is it there?
You don't
there?
Love me, that's why I can't come. I love you, I just can't come. That's my hang-up. I can't come and I'm loaded, all right? Because you don't love me. Just what the hell is the matter with you? What has that got to do with loving you? I just can't come, that's all. Now, if anyone in this room or the world finds those two words decadent, obscene, immoral, amoral, asexual, the words to come really make you feel uncomfortable. If you think I'm rank for saying it to you, you're the beholder gets rank from listening to it, you probably can't come. And then you're of no use, because that's the purpose of life, to recreate it.
It sort of cuts at the end to the very heart of whether or not Lenny Bruce could be tried and convicted of standing on a stage and uttering obscenity if he was able to be as politically astute as he was with the words that he was using. With us on the program to talk about the trials of Lenny Bruce, the authors of the new book, Ron Collins and David Scover. Nat Hentoff is also on the line. And maybe just, gentlemen, between the three of you, you can give us a better sense of whether or not at the end, when, as Nat was describing, Lenny was quoting from his trial transcripts on the stage, he was still a comedian, he was still in control, still in command of that, of his place in trying to challenge the law of the land.
The last time I saw Lenny was in San Francisco, wasn't too long before he died, and the entire act was his trial and a vivid history as applied to him and beyond of the First Amendment, and he was funny.
And you know, he was funny?
He was very funny, and that was the, you know, because offstage, this was a guy whose career, as he would have put it, was in the toilet. You know, in New York, he was desperate to win because, as he said, if I'm busted and convicted in this city, which is supposedly the most liberal city in the country, who's going to want to hire me? And that was the beginning of the end of his career. But still, he was able to make people laugh at this. And his performance was just brilliant. But then I saw him backstage, and he was pretty depressed.
You know, quite often, and to kind of echo some of what Nat has said, and by the way, Nat narrates the CD. We're very honored to have him.
Yeah, I should make a point that on the inside cover of the book, there's a CD that has Nat's voice and a number of Lenny's routines.
But what Lenny was doing, it was just incredible. He was taking his comedy into the courtroom, and he was taking the law of the courtroom into the comedy clubs. I mean, and you couldn't tell one from the other sometimes. And one of the things that's we turned up Lenny secretly recorded, tape recorded his New York trial, portions of it. He had a briefcase made, and he had a tape recorder custom made for the briefcase, and he tape recorded several hours. Well, on the CD, we have his prosecutor cross-examining a witness, and you can hear the prosecutor spouting obscenities, obscene words in the courtroom, an incredible irony going to prove the First Amendment point that Lenny ultimately died for.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to go to Somerville, Massachusetts. Brian's on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I just had an observation about Lenny Bruce is that he's sort of, I mean, his whole role in society is a pretty natural one. It's sort of sacred clown. You know, George Carlin, he referred to it, you know, his occupation is fool. You know, he plays all the parts in his scenarios. He really sort of like spells out, you know, the hypocrisy that drove him crazy and probably fueled his comedy. My question is, actually it's a two-parter. Do you think that First Amendment right cases come a little too late? Like in the case of Lenny Bruce, it pretty much ruined his life. You know, repeatedly being dragged up before courts and, you know, just sort of this treadmill that ended with his death. And is it true that he actually came to court one time wearing no pants? And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
All right, Brian. Thanks a lot for your call. David, I haven't heard from you for a while. I want to make sure you're still with us in Seattle. Are you there?
Yes, I am indeed. let me begin by agreeing with the caller in his first observation that so often First Amendment precedents that protect us today were built on the backs of First Amendment victims. Lenny Bruce was a First Amendment victim in the sense that the First Amendment did not protect him as strongly as it might have. He would have had to pursue it all the way up to the Supreme Court probably in order to be protected. But eventually, it vindicated others for the principle for which he died. Ironically, had Lenny perfected his New York appeal, probably he would not have died a convicted man. His co-defendant, the club owner of the Jazz Workshop, Howard Solomon, who was convicted with him in New York, ended up having his appeal. On appeal, his conviction was overturned.
If I can cut in for a second, David, here, if you'll permit me. Sure. If you want, I'll do it anyway. The whole idea of the First Amendment, though, is that we shouldn't have to have martyrs. I mean, that's the whole idea, so that we don't have to have Lenny Bruce's hanging from the cross, you know? And that's the great tragedy of this story.
Yeah, I'd like to interject at this point because it's an obsession of mine. Roger Baldwin, who founded the ACLU, once told me, no First Amendment victory ever stays a victory. We always have to fight again. And the reason for that is that in our school system, all the way through graduate school, the First Amendment, the rest of the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, is one of the worst taught subjects ever. And the result is that when you have a situation now where the Attorney General keeps chipping away, to put it mildly, most people don't know their constitutional rights. So Lenny was a victim, and there are going to be other victims. There's a case before the Supreme Court this fall where a Ku Klux Klan guy had a cross burning on his own property, actually, and he's up before the Supreme Court, and that is First Amendment protected. There was a famous Supreme Court case on that. But people go on anyway indicting people because they don't understand the First Amendment. Many people in the press don't. So
Matt, let me interrupt you for a minute here.
For a long time.
You interviewed Justice Brennan after he resigned. You asked him at the time, you said, you know, what about obscenity here? His answer to you was, if you can't define it, you can't prosecute people for it. Was he saying, that's why I did what I did, or I shouldn't have done what I did?
What happened was that Brennan, once he got on the court, you mentioned the Roth decision, he was the point man. He wrote many of the obscenity decisions. He tried very hard to find the line between protected speech and unprotected speech. And finally, in one decision, I think it was the California decision, the theater, he wrote, and he told me afterward, I can't find that line anymore. And you'll find that since then, a good many cases don't go to the Supreme Court, although, again, there's one coming up. I'll tell you a quick story about Brennan. Even Brennan, as astute as he was and sensitive as he was, he sent a man named Ralph Ginsburg to prison on a case because Ginsburg had a magazine called Eros that he advertised by using names of cities like Blue Balls, Pennsylvania. He was convicted of pandering as a kind of ancillary of obscenity. And Brennan wrote the decision, and one of his clerks told me that his neck was red as he did it, and I said, how come Brennan did that? And he said, you forget, he had a teenage daughter at the time. So I asked Brennan years later, what about that decision? And he looked at me and said, you don't see it quoted, do you?
Nat, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Nat Hentoff is a longtime columnist with The Village Voice and a writer on constitutional issues. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about Lenny Bruce and his place in the annals of the First Amendment. Do you think, Ron, by putting the book together, you can nudge him a little closer to that, or is he just stuck in culture for the rest of his life in history?
Well, the subtitle of the book is The Fall and Rise of an American Icon. He's back. You know, this is his resurrection. The idea is there's this incredible story. One of the reasons we wrote this book, there was this incredible story about this incredible man, America's foremost comedian, that just really hadn't been told. It involved everybody from one of his first prosecutors, the young Johnny Cochran, to Simon and Garfunkel mentioning him in a song, Bob Dylan writing a song about him, to his some of the foremost lawyers in the country represented this man. It was just an incredible story, and that's why we wrote this book.
Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you on your thoughts of Lenny Bruce, whether you saw him, what he means to you, why he does or does not have the standing in the law that he should. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
I've lost a friend and I don't know why. But never again get together to die.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, a conversation about the trials of Lenny Bruce and his standing as a cultural icon instead of a legal icon when we talk about the First Amendment in this country. And we've been listening to a little bit of Lenny perform. We'll listen to a little bit more, a warning to people who may feel that the content of what Lenny Bruce had to say was a little bit obscene or a little bit racy back in the 1960s, may also be offended by it today, and this is your heads up that if there's kids in the car and you don't want them to listen to it, put on the Raffy tape. 1-800-423-8255. Now let's go with Lenny to the Gate of Horns show that he did in Chicago, the one for which he was busted, sentenced to a year in jail. This is a performance from the 5th of December, 1962. Now, there's a part in the new book by Ron Collins and David Scover when they talk about what was dirty. Lenny Bruce, quote, that they used right at the beginning is, my concept, you can't do anything with anybody's body to make it dirty to me. Six people, eight people, one person. You can only do one thing to make it dirty. Kill it. Hiroshima was dirty. So here he is talking about his Second World War experience, and you can just feel the audience squirming with him as he talks about what he thought was dirty. Adolf Eichmann, the Nazis, Truman dropping the bomb. Here's Lenny Bruce.
You know why they hate Americans anywhere, everywhere? I think I did a little more traveling than anyone in this audience. I think I've been in more invasions than anyone in this audience. I made six. I made some real daddies. I was on a cruiser called the USS Brooklyn. I was a second class gunner's mate. I was making from 42 to 45 July. That's when Germany fell, in July. Doing it dirty. They hate Americans everywhere. You know why? Because we go to their mothers for chocolate bars. And don't you forget that, Jim. You don't think those kids have heard that since 1942? You know what those Americans did? Your poor mother, they lined her up, those bastards. Your poor father had to throw his guts up in the kitchen while he waited out there. That master sergeant stuck your mother for their stinking coffee and their eggs and their friggin' cigarettes, those Americans. That's it, Jim. That's all they've heard, those kids. Those kids now are 23, 25 years old. The Americans. There's the guy that did it to my mother.
Lenny Bruce. David Scover. Nobody's laughing. Is that comedy?
Well, Lenny is giving us an opinion about why Americans are hated. And he's reflecting on the cruelty of the American war victors to the Japanese war victims. If no one's laughing, it's because he's hitting hard. He's hitting the truth, and it's hitting below the gut. This is a fine example of how his political his comedy was laced with political commentary.
You know, he used some Yiddish words in the routine you just mentioned, and those Yiddish words in Los Angeles at the Troubadour, the LAPD. They brought in Sergeant Sherman Block, who knew Yiddish. He took down the words, and Lenny was busted for Yiddish words that were offensive. I mean, it's part of this incredible story of busts in these various cities, and that was one of them he was busted for.
We're going to Brookline, Massachusetts now. Cy and Judith are both on the line. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi. My wife and I attended two performances at the Gate of Horn and once in New York. I just want to recall two things that I recall. In one of the performances, Bruce would come on the stage with the paper of that day. He would start turning pages and making comments on what was in that day's paper, and they were utterly brilliant. It had to be totally spontaneous, of course.
It's written in the book side by the two who are with me today that among the patrons at the show there was that sense of expectancy or almost anxiety. How far is Lenny going to go tonight?
It was very scary, yes, because I knew there were conventioneers in that audience. And the second performance, he said, usually when I hear the chairs scraping, I know people are going to walk out. But this time when I got busted, somebody walked towards me and arrested me. And finally, after he was really in trouble and hard to get work, I heard that he's coming back to Chicago. I called the club, wasn't the Gate of Horn, to find out just when. And the reply was, are you for or against? He was that controversial that they needed to know whether I was going there to make trouble.
Judith, it was often referred to by the prosecutors that there were women in the audience when he was doing this performance.
Yeah,
oh, sure.
I wanted to make a point that connects his love of the human body, love of life, and hitting on words, the meaning of words. He took the word, the F word, and he said of it, if people didn't have such a lousy attitude towards it, it expressed a lousy attitude towards sex, towards human life. If that weren't prevalent, you wouldn't have had all these fatherless kids running around Italy after World War II. There would have been some kind of connection made with their biological fathers, in other words.
Was he obscene, Judith?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
I think he was one of the great social commentator of that period.
I would say that what he gave out, what he delivered, were jeremiads.
I want to thank both of you for calling in.
Thank you for letting us on.
Nice to have you on the program.
Thanks.
Cy and Judith.
1-800-423-8255.
That's our number. We're going next to Amherst, Massachusetts. Allie's on the line. Hi, Allie.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Hi, everybody. You know, I just have a whole different take on this. I was just a baby when he was performing and in legal trouble. But, you know, I really don't think we've produced a society that is better for having defended the Lenny Bruces. I mean, I live in a college town. Every other word is F and B and SH. I mean, we've got a generation that is totally unshockable now. None of this personally, I miss the days when people would demand censure for this kind of performance. I mean, I was just in our local bookshop, which we have lots of out here in Amherst, and I did happen to pick up the book and leaf through it, and I just found myself so turned off that we had a time when this was seen as fine art. I see this as gutter talk, and I'm otherwise, I think, a pretty liberal-minded person, but I'm turned off because the reality is the society we have all around us, which is so crude.
Ron, go ahead.
Allie, your point is well taken, not necessarily that I share your view, but I think it's a legitimate point. Steve Allen, who had defended Lenny Bruce all during his life, toward the end of Steve Allen's life, you know, began to see things a little differently. His views were somewhat similar to yours. And we asked, David and I, when we interviewed Hugh Hefner, who very much defended Lenny Bruce, we asked him, we said, you know, we asked him the very question that you're raising, you know, God, you know, you protect Lenny Bruce and look what it'll produce. And here's the answer, if I could just read for a moment. These are Hugh Hefner's words. He says, what do you get with freedom? Excesses, exploitation. And what does one say to that? A small price to pay. If you don't like it, don't listen to it. Don't read it. Don't watch it. Don't buy it. Without free communication, including the Bulgarians, we don't have a free society. Our democracy is based on it. The First Amendment is first because it is most important. Everything else comes from that. And I think that's the great principle. I think it's a tragedy that Lenny Bruce was prosecuted not only for his words, Allie, but his ideas. And that sort of thing should not exist ever in this country.
Allow me to make an additional point here. Lenny also had a routine which more or less addressed your point, Judith. And that is, he said, if we do these things, why can't we talk about them? You know, why can't we talk about them honestly? So Lenny never looked on his words as offensive. He looked on his words as honest, as real, and as directly addressing what we do. He said, in society's eyes, respectability means under the covers.
Allie, back to you.
I just think that some things should be either unsaid, remain unsaid, or said civilly. I think a lot of this changed for me when I became a parent, and I really had to curb the use of obscenities, which had crept into my language. And so I guess that's just it. I agree that I am going to read the book because I want to push myself into a zone of where I'm not necessarily comfortable. At the same time, I'd like to see a return of saying things truthfully, but in a way that is more palatable than the way it so much is said today. But I will tip my hat by reading this book to somebody who challenged things. So, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for the show.
And thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Nice to have your point of view. To Cambridge, Massachusetts, John's on the line. Hi, John.
Hello?
Yes, hi, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, in my view, Lenny was a First Amendment hero. It's his trials and tribulations that were very much at the fore of why I went to law school and why I want to practice First Amendment law. I believe that the First Amendment guarantees our right to question as vulgarly or as, I guess, politely as the person questioning feels the need to express themselves. And I just feel Lenny was, I guess, crucified for questioning as he felt appropriate.
Go ahead, Brian.
John, I'm sure that Lenny Bruce, I mean this seriously, would be very much honored to know that his work has inspired you to pursue the cause of the First Amendment.
Thank you.
John, let me chime in by saying I share your sentiment. It's very much for the First Amendment that I, too, wanted to go to law school.
There was a contradiction. John, thanks for your call. There was a contradiction in Bruce, though.
There were many.
But the one that keeps coming back in the book is the one that you end with, and that I'm not Lenny Bruce, I'm a comedian, or I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. He was really tangled up over that, and it was almost as if the law, the legal fight that he got his hooks into in the latter years of his life, gave him the sort of passageway through that conundrum.
Yes, I mean, it is. I mean, we interviewed Margaret Cho, the very popular comedian who has a new movie out now called Notorious Cho about this, and she said a really poignant moment. It's on the CD with the book. She said, I want to be like Lenny Bruce, but I don't want to end up like him. And then that really says it all. I mean, if you see her comedy, if you feel it, if you feel that, you know, that liberty just breathing down your neck, you make it. Sometimes you can think it was all worth it, the dues that Lenny paid. But yes, there was this incredible contradiction. Sometimes he was funny, sometimes he wasn't. But I think always he tried to get people to think. And as David said, more than anything else, I think his routines about sex, about politics, about homosexuality, about race, raised a lance time and time again against hypocrisy. And he brought that out in the courtrooms as well. I mentioned he actually sued the judges who were about to pronounce judgment on him in New York. He served them in the courtroom. He sued them for violating his constitutional rights. If that's not moxie, I don't know.
I know. I love the letters that he would write to the judges for which he was charged with contempt. David, there's a quote that you use in the book, and this is Lenny Bruce speaking. He said, "I really don't want to be the great wounded bird flying and trying to break through those weights so we can bring free expression to everybody. I'm a guy who has to work."
Well, Lenny was a comedian who needed to be allowed into the comedy clubs in order to make a living. And so there was that part of him that felt that you know, the prosecutors, the judges were interfering with his rights to a vocation. And I mean, that's what that expresses. But at the same time, and I agree with Ron, Lenny was a very complex character. At the same time, there certainly was a part of Lenny that was willing to be the bird, to be the martyred bird. He knew he was going down, yet he continued to use the dirty words, if you will, in the club. He continued to be prosecuted. He continued to use his last sou, and even if he didn't have money, to defend himself in court for the principle of the First Amendment. Ultimately, what Ron's in my book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, documents is what can go terribly wrong when the First Amendment is cast aside by those who fear freedom.
The system no doubt did him in. I love that Phil Spector line that you quote in the book. Lenny Bruce died of an overdose of police. Ron and David, thanks so much for coming in to talk about the book.
Thank you,
Thank you
for having us.
Ron Collins, David Scover, authors of The Trials of Lenny Bruce. Nat Hentoff was with us a little bit earlier. He's the narrator of the CD collection which accompanies the book. And he's a Village Voice columnist, a specialist on constitutional issues.
Lenny Bruce was bad. He was the brother that you never had.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is W.